This is an RNIB talking book. The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. Read by Anthony Ofebu with Louise Fryer, it lasts 9 hours and 20 minutes. Talking book number 13444. Here's a brief description of the book. Winter is an Earth-like planet with two big differences. The weather conditions are permanently semi-Arctic, and the inhabitants are all the same sex. Hidden in a remote corner of space, beyond their world until an envoy arrives from another planet. It has 20 chapters and is on one CD. This book was first published in 1969. It's been reproduced by permission of the author. This book is copyright. The copyright owner has allowed this copy to be made for the sole use of print-disabled people. No unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, or copying is permitted. Copyright in this recording vests in RNIB.
The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. Dedication for Charles. Sine quo non. Ursula Kroeber Le Guin, daughter of A.L. Kroeber, anthropologist, and Theodora Kroeber, author, was born in Berkeley, California, in 1929. She attended college at Radcliffe and Columbia and married C.A. Le Guin in Paris in 1951. The Le Guins and their three children live in Portland, Oregon. Ursula K. Le Guin's novels include Rocannon's World, Planet of Exile, City of Illusions, and The Left Hand of Darkness, all published by Ace Books. The Left Hand of Darkness, in particular, attracted wide attention and strong praise. It was awarded both the Nebula and the Hugo Awards. With the awarding of the 1975 Hugo and Nebula Awards to The Dispossessed, Ursula K. Le Guin became the first author to win both awards twice for novels. Contents. Introduction. The Gathenian Calendar and Clock. 1. A Parade in Erhenrang. 2. The Place Inside the Blizzard. 3. The Mad King. 4. The 19th Day. 5. The Domestication of Hunch. 6. One Way into Orgorain. 7. The Question of Sex. 8. Another Way into Orgorain. 9. Estraven, the Traitor. 10. Conversations in Mishnori. 11. Soliloquies in Mishnori. 12. On Time and Darkness. 13. Down on the Farm. 14. The Escape. 15. To the Ice. 16. Between Drumna and Dremegol. 17. An Orgota creation myth. 18. On the Ice. 19. Homecoming. 20. A Fool's Errand.
Introduction. Science fiction is often described and even defined as extrapolative. The science fiction writer is supposed to take a trend or phenomenon of the here and now, purify and intensify it for dramatic effect, and extend it into the future. If this goes on, this is what will happen. A prediction is made. Method and results much resemble those of a scientist who feeds large doses of a purified and concentrated food additive to mice in order to predict what may happen to people who eat it in small quantities for a long time. The outcome seems almost inevitably to be cancer. So does the outcome of extrapolation. Strictly extrapolative works of science fiction generally arrive at about where the Club of Rome arrives, somewhere between the gradual extinction of human liberty and the total extinction of terrestrial life. This may explain why many people who do not read science fiction describe it as escapist, but when questioned further, admit they do not read it because it's so depressing. Almost anything carried to its logical extreme becomes depressing, if not carcinogenic. Fortunately, though, extrapolation is an element in science fiction. It isn't the name of the game by any means. It's far too rationalist and simplistic to satisfy the imaginative mind, whether the writers or the readers. Variables are the spice of life. This book is not extrapolative. If you like, you can read it and a lot of other science fiction as a thought experiment. Let's say, says Mary Shelley, that a young doctor creates a human being in his laboratory. Let's say, says Philip K. Dick, that the Allies lost the Second World War. Let's say this or that is such and so and see what happens. In a story so conceived, the moral complexity proper to the modern novel need not be sacrificed, nor is there any built-in dead end. Thought and intuition can move freely within bounds set only by the terms of the experiment, which may be very large indeed. The purpose of a thought experiment, as the term was used by Schrödinger and other physicists, is not to predict the future. Indeed, Schrödinger's most famous thought experiment goes to show that the future, on the quantum level, cannot be predicted, but to describe reality, the present world. Science fiction is not predictive, it's descriptive. Predictions are uttered by prophets, free of charge, by clairvoyants, who usually charge a fee and are therefore more honoured in their day than prophets, and by futurologists, salaried. Prediction is the business of prophets, clairvoyants and futurologists. It is not the business of novelists. A novelist's business is lying. The Weather Bureau will tell you what next Tuesday will be like, and the Rand Corporation will tell you what the 21st century will be like. I don't recommend that you turn to the writers of fiction for such information. It's none of their business. All they're trying to do is tell you what they're like and what you're like, what's going on, what the weather is now, today, this moment, the rain, the sunlight. Look. Open your eyes. Listen. Listen. That is what the novelists say. But they don't tell you what you will see and hear. All they can tell you is what they have seen and heard in their time in this world, a third of it spent asleep and dreaming, another third of it spent in telling lies. The truth against the world. Yes, certainly. Fiction writers, at least in their braver moments, do desire the truth. To know it, speak it, serve it. But they go about it in a peculiar and devious way, which consists in inventing persons, places and events which never did and never will exist or occur, and telling about these fictions in detail and at length and with a great deal of emotion. And then, when they're done writing down this pack of lies, they say, there, that's the truth. They may use all kinds of facts to support their tissue of lies. They may describe the Marshalsea prison, which was a real place, or the Battle of Borodino, which was really fought, or the process of cloning, which really takes place in laboratories, or the deterioration of a personality, which is described in real textbooks of psychology, and so on. This weight of verifiable place, event, phenomenon, behaviour makes the reader forget that he's reading a pure invention, a history that never took place anywhere but in that unlocalizable region, the author's mind. In fact, while we read a novel, we are insane, bonkers. We believe in the existence of people who aren't there. We hear their voices. We watch the Battle of Borodino with them. We may even become Napoleon. Sanity returns, in most cases, when the book is closed. Is it any wonder that no truly respectable society has ever trusted its artists? But our society, being troubled and bewildered, seeking guidance, sometimes puts an entirely mistaken trust in its artists, using them as prophets and futurologists. I do not say that artists cannot be seers, inspired, that the Orwen cannot come upon them, and the God speak through them. Who would be an artist if they did not believe that that happens, if they did not know it happens, because they have felt the God within them use their tongue, their hands, maybe only once in their lives, but once is enough. Nor would I say that the artist alone is so burdened and so privileged. The scientist is another who prepares, who makes ready, working day and night, sleeping and awake for inspiration. As Pythagoras knew, the god may speak in the forms of geometry as well as in the shapes of dreams, in the harmony of pure thought as well as in the harmony of sounds, in numbers as well as in words. But it is words that make the trouble and confusion. We are asked now to consider words as useful in only one way, as signs. Our philosophers, some of them, would have us agree that a word, sentence, statement, has value only insofar as it has one single meaning, points to one fact which is comprehensible to the rational intellect, logically sound, and ideally quantifiable. Apollo, the god of light, of reason, of proportion, harmony, number, Apollo blinds those who press too close in worship. Don't look straight at the sun. Go into a dark bar for a bit and have a beer with Dionysus every now and then. I talk about the gods, I am an atheist. But I am an artist too, and therefore a liar. Distrust everything I say. I am telling the truth. The only truth I can understand or express is, logically defined, a lie. Psychologically defined, a symbol. Aesthetically defined, a metaphor. Oh, it's lovely to be invited to participate in futurological congresses where systems science displays its grand apocalyptic graphs and to be asked to tell the newspapers what America will be like in 2001 and all that, but it's a terrible mistake. I write science fiction, and science fiction isn't about the future. I don't know any more about the future than you do, and very likely less. This book is not about the future. Yes, it begins by announcing that it's set in the ecumenical year 1490-97, but surely you don't believe that. Yes, indeed, the people in it are androgynous, but that doesn't mean that I'm predicting that in a millennium or so we will all be androgynous, or announcing that I think we damned well ought to be androgynous. I'm merely observing in the peculiar, devious and thought-experimental manner proper to science fiction that if you look at us at certain odd times of day in certain weathers, we already are. I'm not predicting or prescribing. I am describing. I'm describing certain aspects of psychological reality in the novelist's way, which is by inventing elaborately circumstantial lies. In reading a novel, any novel, we have to know perfectly well that the whole thing is nonsense, and then, while reading, believe every word of it. Finally, when we're done with it, we may find, if it's a good novel, that we're a bit different from what we were before we read it, that we've been changed a little, as if, by having met a new face, crossed a street we never crossed before. But it's very hard to say just what we learnt, how we were changed. The artist deals with what cannot be said in words. The artist whose medium is fiction does this in words. The novelist says in words what cannot be said in words. Words can be used thus paradoxically because they have, along with a semiotic usage, a symbolic or metaphoric usage. They also have a sound, a fact the linguistic positivists take no interest in. A sentence or paragraph is like a chord or harmonic sequence in music. Its meaning may be more clearly understood by the attentive ear, even though it's read in silence, than by the attentive intellect. All fiction is metaphor. Science fiction is metaphor. What sets it apart from older forms of fiction seems to be its use of new metaphors, drawn from certain great dominants of our contemporary life, science, all the sciences, and technology, and the relativistic and the historical outlook among them. Space travel is one of these metaphors. So is an alternative society, an alternative biology. The future is another. The future in fiction is a metaphor. A metaphor for what? If I could have said it non-metaphorically, I would not have written all these words, this novel, and generally I would never have sat down at my desk and used up my ink and typewriter ribbon in informing me and you, rather solemnly, that the truth is a matter of the imagination. Ursula K. Le Guin. The Gethenian Calendar and Clock. The Year. Gethin's period of revolution is 8,401 Terran standard hours, or 0.96 of the Terran standard year. The period of rotation is 23.08 Terran standard hours, The Cathenian year contains 364 days. In Karhide, Ogorain, years are not numbered consecutively from a base year forward to the present. The base year is the current year. Every New Year's Day, Gethany Thurn, the year just passed becomes the year one ago, and every past date is increased by one. The future is similarly counted, next year being the year one to come, until it in turn becomes the year one. The inconvenience of this system in record keeping is palliated by various devices, for instance, reference to well-known events, reigns of kings, dynasties, local lords, etc. The Yomeshta count in 144-year cycles for the birth of Mesthe, 2022 years ago in ecumenical year 1492, and keep ritual celebrations every 12th year. But this system is strictly cultic and is not officially employed even by the government of Ogorain, which sponsors the Yomesh religion. The month. The period of revolution of Gethen's moon is 26 Gethenian days. There are 14 months in the year, and as solar and lunar calendars concur so closely that adjustment is required only about once in 200 years, the days of the month are invariable, as are the days of the phases of the moon. The Karhidish names of the months: winter, 1, Thurn, 2, Thanurn, 3, Nimmer, 4, Anna, spring, 5, Irem, 6, Moth, 7, Tua, summer, 8, Osme, 9, Okre, 10, Kus, 11, Hakana, autumn, 12, Gore, 13, Susmi, 14, Grende. The 26-day month is divided into two half-months of 13 days. The day. Being invariable, the days of the month are generally referred to by name, like our days of the week, not by number. Many of the names refer to the phase of the moon, e.g. Gethany, darkness, Arhad, first crescent, etc. The prefix od, used in the second half-month, is a reversive, giving a contrary meaning. So that od Gethany might be translated as undarkness. The Karhidish names of the days of the month: 1, Gethany, 2, Sordni, 3, Eps, 4, Arhad, 5, Netherhad, 6, Streth, 7, Burni, 8, Orni, 9, Hahahad, 10, Gurni, 11, Yerni, 12, Posthe, 13, Tormenbod, 14, Odgetheni, 15, Odsordni, 16, Odeps, 17, Odahad, 18, Onethahad, 19, Odstreth, 20, Obeni, 21, Odoni, 22, Odhahahad, 23, Odgurni, 24, Oderni, 25, Oposthi, 26, Otomenbod. The day is divided into 10 hours. First hour, noon to 2:30 p.m. Second hour, 2:30 to 5 p.m. Third hour, 5 to 7 p.m. Fourth hour, 7 to 9:30 p.m. Fifth hour, 9:30 to midnight. Sixth hour, midnight to 2:30 a.m. Seventh hour, 2:30 to 5 a.m. Eighth hour, 5 to 7 a.m. Ninth hour, 7 to 9:30 a.m. Tenth hour, 9:30 to noon.